Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
What's most people think? Lockdown.
Hello and welcome to episode 68 of What Most People Think. I am recording this intro on Thursday night. It's Thursday the 17th of December. We've got more new people going up into Tier 3. Solidarity with all my Tier 3 comrades there. Big shout going out to Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire, Surrey, apart from Waverley, for reasons that I don't understand. I don't know what's going on in Waverley there. Fucking some weird mutant strain of pensioner that is somehow immune to all this stuff. But it's all starting, isn't it? Of course, we all knew that this was going to happen. Is that we're not going to get the Christmas that we were promised. We can't have that after this year where we've had so much taken away from us. We had this 5 days where we would be able to sort of see our families, but even that could be too much. And the government have stressed that we all need to exercise personal responsibility. And the reaction to that idea was astonishing. It was like, I mean, it's been a rough year generally for personal responsibility, hasn't it? It's sort of what was once a mainstay of all the bedrock of political thought was that citizens should broadly just not act like fucking idiots. But now it gets mentioned. Everyone's like, what? It doesn't compute. It's like this mad batshit idea that Gwyneth Paltrow's peddling. I guess this is what happens when you signed 3,064 Apple updated terms and conditions without reading a single thing, isn't it? We don't know what's going on with Apple. They could just turn up in a van one day and just say, right, we're here, we're going to harvest your limbs, we're trying to reanimate the corpse of Steve Jobs. And I don't know if you realise, but in the last, like, 1,000... things that you've signed up to, we've repeatedly asked you if it was okay if we could take your organs and limbs to bring bring Steve Jobs back to life, and you have said yes, like, repeatedly. So I think it's beyond doubt here that we just get in the fucking van. So yeah, I don't know, man, but this is what most people think. A podcast coming to you in the week where the idea that right-wing comedians should maybe have some portion of the airtime on topical comedy shows was once again controversial. You know, it turned out that there was, I don't know if you saw the report, but there were, well, it's interesting because the right-wing press chose to focus on the fact that like 70-75% of comics across TV and radio were sort of left-wing liberal Romani types. What they didn't mention was that zero spots, because I think the only spots they could find given to right-of-centre comics were me and Giles Brandriff. I'm sure Giles Brandriff is a very funny man. I'm not even sure he would describe himself as a mainstay of the stand-up circuit. But look, for the time being, that balance doesn't exist in television. But the great thing about comedy at the moment is that's not the only place you can find it. You can have it here on this podcast where sometimes it's me wanging on. Sometimes I have a comedian like Leo Kirst or Constantine Kissin or an Andrew Doyle. Or sometimes I have a guest like I do today, which is also people that I find politically unconventional. And today's guest is Paul Embury is he's an interesting figure. He's been Labour all his life. He's been a trade union man all his life. So naturally, of course, he's a contentious figure on the left. But he is part of what he would call, I guess, blue Labour, blue collar Labour. He represents perhaps more socially conservative values on the left, and it's an interesting place to be. So, you know, I had an interview with him earlier, and look, I tried not to give him an easy ride because it turns out I do agree with a lot of stuff he said, but also tried to challenge him on some of the things his critics would put to him. Because the last thing we want to be like one of these shows where it's just people agreeing with each other, right? But anyway, I think you'll like him as a guest. And a lot of people in the Patreon community have asked for me to chat to Paul. And here he is, right? This is the thing. Patreons. The power of the Patreon. By the way, the power of the Patreon is, the reason I'm recording this late on Thursday is I've re-recorded the intro because I listened to it back and it was so shit. I don't know what was going on with me earlier. I finished it. I thought, yeah, fucking nailed that. I put it on my phone. I thought, I'll go for a little drive. I'll have a listen to that while I'm going out. And I was absolute dog shit. Absolute dog shit. But this is when you've got clients. I've got patrons who I have to deliver for now. This is a great thing about capitalism. It focuses the mind. And we have some new patrons this week. We've got just somebody who calls himself F. Just F on its own. Just some weird... Perhaps I've got my first non-binary Patreon there. I don't identify as a name. I think names are very reductive. So just someone called Nick. And someone called Nicholas Tall. Nicholas God. You know, we spoke on the other week on the podcast about if you've got one of those names that implies something positive, but you're like, you know, if your name's Hope or Destiny and your life's in the shitter. Just imagine if poor old Nicholas Tall is not tall. You know, it's just an irony that he has to face. I hope he's at least rocking in 6 foot, because if he's like 5 foot three, that's a bad irony to have to face every single day of his fucking life. But I thank you for your contribution to the Patreon. And the key thing that the Patreon does at the moment, which people seem to be appreciating, is that it keeps it weekly, but more importantly at the moment, it keeps it ad-free. Because a lot of podcasts, I understand people want to make money their way and put adverts on. No issue with that. I've chosen this way and you're helping me keep it ad-free. Okay, so I appreciate you helping me and allowing me to do that. Because it's a bit different when you're a right-of-centre comic. I would probably, they'd be wary of what I was going to say about things like Black Lives Matter or trans issues. So it's just better for content if it's sort of self-funded. And also, it avoids me having moments like this. Bing, bong, bing. Hi, I'm Jeff Norcott. And this Christmas, I'm using Skidaddle. What? Yeah, boy. Skidaddle is a brand new banging app that reminds me of things I've got to do. And if I'm running late, Skidaddle. Yeah, boy. It sets a timer 5 minutes before I need to leave the house and administers a small electric shock to make sure that I go. From the makers of Shitbox. Bing, bong, bing. I don't know what that bing, bong, bing thing is. I don't know where... That sounds like an 80s... 80s department store, do you know what I mean? About like I'm going to go and stroke Mrs. Slocum's pussy. And if there's any millennials listening, you've got to go and Google that and work that out for yourself. We do a cuss count every week, just tracking the trends in swearing. Got a big apology to my friend and a friend of the show is David Domain. He did supply the cuss count for the previous show and I just left it out. But believe it or not, I've actually forgot to include it in the document this week. But I have got last week's cuss count from the episode with Leo. And a lot of people seem to really like that episode. They just said it was funny. And that's the point, isn't it? Just being funny. Political comedians, you don't just get to make a point about politics, all right? I mean, today's a bit different because I'm doing an interview where I'm trying to seem smart in front of somebody who's got their own book out. But you've got to do jokes. And Leo did jokes. And do check out that episode because a lot of people seem to have enjoyed it. But let's just do the scores on the doors. So the swear words this week are off the Vidi printer, fucking 21, piss 2, piss is 1, prick 1, prickery 1, shit 5, shit 1, shit scared 1, shit storm 1, shitty 1. There's a lot of shit here, isn't there? Evidently, I was a bit backed up last week. And wank 2, just 2 wanks there. It reminds me of my teenage years, that does. And that was 0.6. per minute. That's not bad with a guest. I thought we'd swear more with Leo there. Leo, the big 6 foot fucking 9 tough guy of right wing comedy. He only swore twice during the podcast. So he was an excellent guest though. But he delivered. Speaking of delivering, because somebody said to me last week my links were shit, so I'm going to do some really clunky links here. I've just got to say something about PMQs, by the way. So Prime Minister's Question Time, I usually encounter what's happened first up on Twitter. And the way that people exaggerate how well Starmer has done is just off the chart, right? So broadly speaking, he does do better than Boris Johnson. He frequently does better. He's better at the dispatch box. I think he's a brighter guy, certainly sharper with language. But they have to add a bit of VAT, don't they, the left? They're like, oh my God, oh my God. Starmer absolutely eviscerated Johnson today. He annihilated Johnson. It was embarrassing. He wore Boris Johnson's face as a mask. He painted his name on Boris Johnson in Boris Johnson's blood. You know, okay, all right, fucking hell, better check out this PMQs. And then you kind of watch it and you think, yeah, no, he's made some good points there. He's sort of still not picking a position himself, but he's going at Boris here. And then the usual thing where Boris sort of looks like he's going to be completely overwhelmed. Do you ever notice that, where you think, oh, he's going, the old long COVID's kicking in? And then he did fight back a bit. He made a point that perhaps even some people on the left would make about Starmer, is that it would help his cause a little bit if he had a cause. What a soundbite that was. I'm going to say that again. It would help his cause a bit if he had a cause. If he picked a fucking team, old Keir Splinter, from sitting on the fence, eh? Keir Splinter, was that a good one? Would that catch on? I don't know. Certainly not as good as Keir Starmer. If somebody ever wants to send the actual lyrics into that, because I've just sort of made up noises, really. But what they do when they do that about PMQs is they overhype it. And then if you're perhaps like more neutral about Boris Johnson, like me, you sort of think, oh, Jesus Christ, better watch this. And your thought when you come away isn't Boris Johnson didn't do as well as Starmer there. You think, well, he didn't do as bad as they said he did. Right? That's the problem with hype, isn't it? They're like those people that were saying the film Joker was better than Taxi Driver, weren't they? Speaking of films, there you go. There's another clunking fucking link there. I watched Wonder Woman yesterday. I watched Wonder Woman 1984 at the cinema. And I got to say, man, one thing I love about the Wonder Woman film is obviously, look, it's supposed to be a bit feministy, right? It's a female lead written, produced, directed by Patty Jenkins. So it's supposed to be like a bit empowering for the women, and it's got a lot more empathy in it. You know, like Wonder Woman doesn't kill people. I just sort of thought, first off, I'm not sure about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you had a female superhero, like the idea that she'd be like, oh, mercy for you. Fucking, yeah. I don't think that the history of female dictators and queens, as we look back on them, suggests that there'd be much more mercy if women had unique powers. But what I thought was hilarious about it was they come from this place, Amazonia or something, where it's this all-female society. But they are like the hottest women you've ever seen in your life. They have this sporting contest at the beginning, and they're just all walking around like, I mean, they're all like 6 foot and can, they 6 foot Victoria's Secrets models that can do backflips and throw spears. I don't know. If that's feminism, I'm in. Right? And even when they call for like the societal elders, you go, all right, maybe we'll have someone here that won't look quite. Oh, no, there's straight nine as well. Even though this woman is in her mid 50s, she is still like absolutely smoking hot. So I don't know. I don't know. Is that thing where women say, no, they look good for them. Okay. They're looking good for them. No men around. It's not like men are good. It's not in any way an attempt to drag men into see the film that they might not otherwise see. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm kind of marketing it on that basis. But yeah, I would say that the first half an hour, it's very good. Very good. You can just leave then, like a pervert. Go, that's all right, going to get a bit boring now and a bit preachy. But they look good in those outfits, didn't they? Anyway, enjoy the rest of the film, everyone. We always do a thank you and a fuck you. Thank you, actually, to View Cinema for just being open. You got to go to the cinema to see the big films. Don't let cinemas die. There's one open. Look, and also between Christmas and New Year, you're going to want to get out of the house, because I think we're all facing this reality now. As we get into Christmas, because you know, it's like you do your family thing, but we think, oh, we'll see your friends that day, you see so and so that day. You ain't getting none of that this Christmas, right? If you're observing the rules, you ain't getting none of that. So you're going to want to get out of the fucking house, trust me. So have a look at the cinema, whatever old shit they've got, just go there and sleep. Just go and sleep in a cinema, you know. I just can't abide these people that are like, no, but the thing is, I'm happy to watch films at home. You know, the screen we've got now with my Sony 1080D fucking curve. No, your screen is not better than a cinema. I'll tell you why, because your dog will come and jump up in your fucking lap. You're probably going to have your phone on. And also, where else are you going to eat a tub of popcorn the size of your fucking head and not think it's weird? Do you know what I mean? I don't care. Sometimes when you're at home, you go, oh, make popcorn. But you make one of those little packets and stuff. It's always a bit annoying, isn't it? The kernel's never fully burst in the end if you're a fat bastard like me. Do you ever have that thing when you make the microwavable popcorn and then you end up eating the kernels because it's got to be... No, just me on that one. Fair enough. Okay, and a fuck you. The fuck you goes to Amazon. Amazon, and I'm not like, you know, like these lefty comics will go at them on their, you know, the fact that they should redistribute in their wealth. I think mainly I just want them to redistribute my packages on time. But I don't know what's going on, man. The paper that they're using in the packaging this year smells like vomit. It smells like vomit. I don't know what's going on with Jeff Bezos. Maybe he's had to do a bit of cost cutting there because, you know, he hasn't done quite as well out of this pandemic yet as he feels like he needs to. But you check it out. The next time you get a piece of Amazon packaging, the paper smells like vomit. I don't know. Is that a sign of how is that a sign of how bad it's got in the workshops? You know what I mean? Just keep going. But Jeff, I feel sick. Keep going. Make Jeff Bezos more money. Anyway, now let's get into the chat with acclaimed left-wing social commentator and now author, Paul Embury. Okay, so welcome to What Most People Think, making his first appearance, is Mr. Paul Embury. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for being on. Now, a lot of my listeners will already know who you are, but it'd be good if you could just sort of situate, you know, who you are, where your politics are coming from in a general sense.
Okay, so I'm on the left. I've been a part of the Labour movement for around 26 years now. I'm a trade unionist. I'm also a firefighter by trade. That's my primary job. I also
easy ladies. I can hear them already.
They can't see me. If they could, they might not be.
I don't know. A man can pull off that colour hair, and you know, you're doing great, mate. You've got a lot of fans out there.
Flattery will get you everywhere, Jeff. So yeah, that's my day job as a firefighter. I do a bit of media work. I do a bit of writing. I'm a columnist for Unheard. But yes, I've been active in the Labour movement for 26 years as a trade unionist. I've been a member of the Labour Party for that time as well. I grew up in the East London borough of Barking and Dagenham, a pretty sort of working class blue collar community. And that kind of experience growing up in that place has informed my politics really to a large degree. And I've just had a book published called Despised: Why the Modern Left Loathe the Working Class. And that sets out a lot of my arguments.
So why are, I mean, it'd be fair to say that you are of the left, you've been a member of the Labour Party, you still are, I presume?
Yes.
Yeah, you vote. I know that you voted, you know, even with your issues with Corbyn and the Labour Party, you voted Labour at the last election. Mm-hmm. So why are you such a contentious figure to some people on the left?
I think largely because the left itself has gone through a radical transformation over the last 20 or 30 years. What were once upon a time pretty conventional mainstream positions and opinions on the left have almost suddenly become taboo. And anyone who still kind of holds on to those opinions is regarded as anathema, is regarded as kind of like the enemy within. And there's now a rigid kind of orthodoxy on the left. You know, so much of the left wants diversity in everything but opinion.
Tell me about it, mate. This week, political comedy on telly. I can't go there anymore.
you know as much as anybody. You know, you're probably better than anybody. And you know, the truth is, if you stand against that, particularly if you're someone like me, you do it within the movement itself.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, you're the devil incarnate. And the left has, you know, I've watched it transform. The left has become very, very dominant now with this kind of middle class liberal student social activist kind of cohort of person, people living in our fashionable cities. And whereas once upon a time there was a very sort of rich thread on the left of working class culture,
yeah,
blue collar communities who were active on the left, the left has almost withdrawn from those places, and those places in turn have pretty much rejected the left, as we saw at the last
election. Yeah, I mean, I think we should put some flesh on the bones here, because people often say that. We'll give examples. First up, just sort of dial back a little bit. You mentioned a beliefs that might be taboo on the left. Could you just give an example of what one of those beliefs?
Yeah, I'll give an example. For example, the issue of immigration. Not that long ago, it was a mainstream view on the left that regulation of the labour supply was important, that you know, control of the labour supply was a market dynamic which, like all market dynamics, needed to be regulated to provide the best outcome for workers, allow governments to plan around welfare and housing and employment and all of that sort of thing. You know, also because I think many people on the left realise that you couldn't just have a system where, you know, you had rapid and large scale movements of people in and out of working class communities, with some of the pressures that would bring. It's something I saw at close quarters in my own borough of Barking and Dagenham.
Do you mean by that, like, I mean, obviously there's the, you know, certainly in terms of manual trades, there might be, you know, serious price competition, undercutting, you know, some people would argue that. But are we also talking kind of like social pressures of rapid change in communities?
We're talking exactly that. So social and economic disruption. And my argument is that rapid and large scale movements of labour can cause the same kind of social and economic disruption as rapid and large scale movements of capital. And when you put the two together, which is what globalisation is all about, that's when you have whirlwinds ripping through usually working class communities, hard pressed communities. So it's the economic impact of people who might be in particular sectors of industry where, you know, there's an oversupply of labour suddenly, and that can exert downward pressure on wages. And there's a social and cultural impact as well, which is particularly what I saw in Barking and Dagenham, where people just start to feel a sense of disorientation. They feel everything that they were kind of familiar with, a settled and stable community, if it's subject to large movements of people coming in, then that can violate people's sense of order. And I contend that's, for the most part, absolutely not in a racist way. I'm pro-immigration, by the way. I think it's brought benefits to our country. I'd like to see more of it. I just think it needs to be better planned and better controlled. Otherwise, what you do is you create anger and disorientation, usually in working class communities, and you get kicked back against it.
Yeah.
And I think the really sad thing is we were kind of going through a process as a country where we were improving in terms of our approach to immigration. It was almost becoming a bit of a dead issue in our country. You know, you go back to the 70s when the National Front was on the march and that kind of thing, Enoch Powell. We'd kind of put the issue to bed largely. And then as a result of kind of EU free movement and the impacts of globalization and the fact that the political establishment, particularly the left, just said to people, well, this is good for you. Get on with it. Don't complain about it.
High watermark of that would have, I suppose, been the comment of Gordon Brown to Gillian Duffy, which was to take a reasonable question about immigration and just go, oh, that's a bigoted woman.
Exactly, and indicative of the approach of much of the left. You know, raise concerns about it and you must instinctively be a bigot. And that kind of approach has turned an issue which was becoming a bit of a non-issue into a running sore in our politics and in our society. And the left, particularly responsible for it, has got to look at the way it handled the issue. It demonised people as racists and bigots and xenophobes just for simply saying that this is having a pretty serious impact and rapid impact in our community. Can we just slow it down a bit? Because it's creating social and economic disruption. And that's an example of how even voicing that kind of moderate opinion now gets you demonized on the left. And, you know, the other thing that really annoys me about the left's approach to this is that open borders, which is something that actually Bernie Sanders, who's a hero to the international left, as to his credit, recognized, that it's a boss's dream. You know, whereas once upon a time, if you wanted to save money on labour costs, you would have to sort of transfer your operations to the Far East or wherever.
Yeah.
Free movement laws just gives them the opportunity to do that in reverse. You know, they can shift workers from low-wage economies to high-wage economies and drive down labour costs in that way. And so many people on the left don't see
that. So just, again, just to maybe do with the sort of help people out of the jargon, open borders. I mean, this is one of these concepts that we know about because we're on social media with these people sort of slogging it out day in, day out. But it's such an absolutist concept that there are a lot of people that just believe freedom of movement shouldn't just be within the EU. It should be a concept broadly applied across the planet, right?
Yeah.
It actually makes it hard to say because I sort of think the people that agree with it, I don't want it to happen because I think that the discord that would go with it would be so great. But I just love them to have at least a week of seeing the consequence of the absolute clusterfuck that it would be if that happened. And it's not about not liking people from other places. It's about realizing that that it would create such vacuums. It would create, some places would be deserted. Some places would be overwhelmed, but it's a nice thing to say, though, isn't it? Maybe that's why they like it. It feels good to say it.
It feels good to say it. It gives the impression, look, you know, peace, love and harmony. We're all in favour of people going where they want to go, loving who yeah. they want to love in the place they want to love them and working where
oh,
they
yeah,
want
yeah. to. Oh, yeah, yeah, to live, all, love and work.
Yeah, yeah, all of this sort of stuff. But you hit on a point there, which is something that's often not covered in this debate, is when you do have a system of free movement like we do in the EU, which allows the large-scale movement of people from low-wage economies to high-wage economies, because let's be blunt, it's never the other way around. You don't really get British workers en masse going to Romania or Lithuania or places like this in order yeah. to kind of improve their lot. The traffic is all one way.
Unless they're on the run from the CSA or something. Those sort of blokes. They often end up, I knew a few blokes like in the early noughties that ended up in Indonesia. That's
the people you mix with, Jeff, obviously. So. but yeah. you look at, there was a story in The Guardian a year or two ago, which talked about a crisis in the Romanian health service, where 43,000 doctors had left the health service since the Romania's accession to the EU in 2004, I think it was. And they'd travelled, you know, further to Western Europe. And that has created a real health service with a lack of doctors in Romania. You look at Latvia. Latvia has got effectively a depopulation crisis, which I mentioned in the book, where I think around a fifth of its workers or something have just kind of decamped and gone to higher wage economies. So what you have with a system of free movement between highly diverse economies, you have the oversupply of labour in certain sectors in the richer economy, which pushes down wages and impacts on people's wages, and the depopulation crisis in the lower wage economies, which creates real problems in those countries. This is stuff. The truth is, Jeff, this is a complex, multifaceted issue, and it requires a lot of thought. And just simply saying open borders, everyone go where they want, and if you don't like that, you're a racist or a xenophobe, is trite, and it doesn't take the debate forward.
I mean, that is, you know, I see some of the things that people apply to you and call you, you know, racist, far right, dog whistles, all these sort of things. I mean, just say, playing devil's advocate here, what is it about what you're saying? Where are they getting that from? What are the kind of things that you say that lead them down that path?
Oh, I think, you know, if you, for example, my book was denounced, and you may have seen it on social media. My book was denounced by some people on the left as, you know, a far-right manifesto or a fascist tract. Most of them hadn't even read it by that point. Some of that was before it was
released. To minor details, Paul. You don't need to
minor details.
Have a view these days.
Yeah, but they just knew. They just knew it was some sort of fascist tract. And the only reason they came to this view, some of them, was that in the synopsis, you know, the synopsis basically is an overview of my beliefs, which is that, you know, in order to be relevant again, the Labour Party needs to combine socialist economics, so a radical sort of economic policy, with a return to the cultural politics of place and belonging and community, instead of the kind of open borders, citizen of nowhere, cosmopolitan liberalism that it's embraced. But that was enough. That simple part about saying we needed a return to the cultural politics of place and belonging and community was enough to people to say, this is a homage to the Vichy regime. This is far right stuff. This is fascism in disguise. And that shows, frankly, how away with the fairies some people.
Well, I mean, it's sometimes that argument is also characterised as somewheres versus anywheres, isn't there? There's a lot of people that are just happy to, whatever city has what they want, you know, kind of like restaurant districts, theatre districts, amenities, certain kinds of schools, nothing against them, do you know what I mean? Like, that's their priority. They would live there. They wouldn't mind how far it was from the conurbation in which they grew up. Whereas some people are, so that'd be anywheres. So somewheres are people who've made an important thing of living within the community and staying within the community that they grew up in. I mean, I remember when I did the documentary of how the middle classes were in Britain, I spoke to people just like, you know, we want it to be good here. You know, we want investment in this town, so it makes sense to carry on living in this town. And I've got to be honest, even as someone who grew up in London, I was like, but you don't really, do you? You want to go and work in city centre Nottingham? They were like, no. And it took me a while to really get my head around the fact that, oh, yeah, not everyone wants to live in a fucking city.
And that point is covered really well by David Goodhart, the writer, particularly in his book called The Road to Somewhere, where he kind of says the country is, you know, divided to a certain degree between the somewheres and the anywheres. And as you say, the somewheres are people who are generally on lower wages, less in the way of opportunity for travel and career advancement, etc. Much more rooted, much more parochial, often because they have less opportunity, and you know, tend to be based in the provinces, whereas the anywheres, generally better paid, often university educated, great opportunities in the way of travel and career advancement, and they see the world from anywhere rather than somewhere. And what David Goodhart says in his book, and I think he describes it really well, is that the country is made up of about 50% somewheres, about 25% anywheres, and the rest kind of in betweeners. But the problem is the political establishment, and particularly the left establishment, is dominated by anywheres. So they see the world through the lens of anywhere rather than somewhere. And go, you know, that goes back to the issue, for example, of free movement. You know, for the anywhere group, free movement's a great thing. You know, they've been to university, they might have travelled abroad during their gap year, they might be able to go and work abroad in Europe as a result of their job. But if you're a somewhere and those opportunities simply are not available to you, and your only experience of free movement is a large number of people coming in, working in your industry, perhaps pushing your wages down, you know, not their fault, of course, but nonetheless, that's the effect of it, then you might not see free movement as such a good thing. But this is the problem. The anywheres dominate our culture, they dominate our politics, and so they implement policies which they think are in the national interest, but are in fact in the anywhere interest. And that's I think, a good way of describing the divide that's broken out in our country over the last couple of decades.
Just cutting into the chat with Paul Embry there. Hope you're enjoying it. Just a little tickle on the tour stuff. Venues are selling out. I think there's 3 or 4 sellouts now. There's some venues, like, it's almost gone. All the London dates are almost gone. Manchester's almost gone. And I'm just saying, like, you go, Jeff, you just want to sell your tickets and sleep at night. Yes, maybe there is a bit of that. But also, I also know from having done this, being my 4th tour, is when those venues do sell out, people just go to me and go, fucking hell, fucking sold out, could you give us a heads up? Even though that's literally all I talk about. And also the book, Where Did I Go Right? Brackets, How the Left Lost Me. And then for regular listeners, that is the first time I've remembered the title at first go. It is written. It's there waiting for you. If you pre-order it, you'd be doing me a solid. And also, there is probably, some of you have got a missus or a husband where, you know, they keep badgering you. Well, you haven't given me any ideas yet. They're just trying to put an excuse for giving you a shit present. Don't give them that excuse. Tell them that you want my book or tour tickets or both, and just tell them to print it out, stick it in a box, fucking wrap it up. Just before we go back to the chat with Paul, one of my listeners, James Hargreave, he took the time to put together like a 12 Days of Christmas compilation of me swearing during the cuss count. And just a bit of fun before we go back to the serious political chat, this is what he came up with. On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love said to me, 24 fuckings, I think that's actually a record. 2 cunt muppets, 20 fuckings, it's kind of standard, 13 shits. And 3 wankies. 40-something fuck words. 1 arse, 1 bastard, 2 twats, 24 fuckings. 1 piss, 7 shits, 2 piss, 1 pissing, 2 pissies, a lot of piss. 18 fuckers. I think that's 3 shows in a row now. 1 shat, past tense of shit. 1 ape shit, 1 bullshit, 1 bat shit. Fuck. Sorry, I didn't mean that. I sort of hiccuped as I said it. Fuck. I love that. Anyway, let's get back to the chat with Paul.
What most people think lockdown,
I think that, you know, one thing I don't want to do is just give an easy ride, because there's a lot of what you're saying that makes sense to me. You know, there was something that you said there about driving down wages. Now, we saw through the EU referendum and subsequently a lot of people claiming that this simply, you know, wasn't true about wage depression. What sort of stats and facts have you got to kind of back that up?
Well, I mean, what the point that I make in the book is that the impact of immigration in terms of wages as a whole is broadly negligible. Okay, there's some evidence saying it improves wages broadly, some evidence saying it doesn't improve wages. But the point that I make in the book is actually, when you drill down into it a little bit more, you can see evidence that it has an impact at the lower end of the scale in terms of lower wages and also on wage distribution. So, for example, a Bank of England report showed that for every 10 percentage point increase in the number of immigrants in skilled or semi-skilled jobs, it can impact on wages by 2%. Now, 2% might not seem a lot to people, but if you're not on a very good wage, it can be, you know, over the course of a year, it can be an appreciable blow. And also, we saw stories, and I cite them in my book, we saw stories coming out after the referendum where a slowdown in the rate of EU workers coming to Britain had created a shortage of labour in certain industries. So, for example, retail and catering and hospitality. And those industries, as a result, saw some of the sharpest sudden increase.
Yes, yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, pay settlements were going up in those sectors.
Yeah, because of the shortage. And you know, the truth is, labour is no different to anything else. If you have an oversupply of it, it drives the individual cost down. I mean, that's an iron law of economics. It can also have an impact on, as I say, wage distribution. So you know, the share of wages, how it's distributed, affects people at the lower end of the scale. And often there's evidence showing that migrants' wages themselves in Britain are impacted by large-scale immigration. So I think, you know, I've never made the case, and I don't make the case in the book, that immigration will automatically affect everybody's wages and the nation will be poorer. Because, as I say, the evidence is negligible. But for the lower end, people at the lower end of the scale, who I care about, I'm a working-class person, I've been a trade union rep, I represent those people, that's where the evidence is that it hits people hardest. And we should be honest about that, and trade union leaders should be honest about that, rather than denying it.
Well, I think it's a fair point in a way, because what I found at one point was the exact same people that would be kind of boasting to me about how cheap they got a conservatory done with people from Eastern Europe, right, would then be dismissing the idea that that might have had any knock-on effects in labourers. And I'll go as far as saying that there started to become an open contempt for skilled tradesmen in this country. Like because there was a cheap alternative. I think the same thing happened with Uber and black taxi drivers. People really loved Uber because of the convenience and the cost. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've sat in black cabs and heard some dodgy opinions from black cab drivers like anybody else. But it was, you know, they were not the majority. But yeah, they seemed to develop a sort of contempt for people that had learnt their trade, got qualified in this country, but were daring to charge like a rate that recognised their own value.
And there's utter hypocrisy that runs through their argument. I mean, another example you could use is farm workers, you know, fruit pickers, agricultural workers. The same people who swear blind that free movement does not affect wages and does not drive down wages are the same people usually who are arguing that, hey, after Brexit, if we don't have huge numbers of farm workers coming in from Eastern Europe picking our strawberries, then, you know, we're not going to be able to have fruit because the British people are just not prepared to do that sort of work. Well, actually, what they mean is British people are not prepared to do it for the pittance that's often paid to Eastern European workers to do it.
What most people think.
So you mentioned earlier about your care for kind of migrant workers as well. Is there a danger, and I apply this to myself, that when we talk about the working classes, when we say normal everyday people, if we're honest, are we thinking white working class? Is that a danger?
Well, it's a danger, and you know, we need to steer clear of it. I'm constantly accused on social media and elsewhere of banging on about the white working class, of you know, flying the flag of the white working class. Actually, if you look at the history of, you know, the columns I've been writing over recent years, all of my tweets over the last 10 years, the number of times I've mentioned white working class is probably no more than about 20 or 25 times, and that's in 10 years, and that's strictly in context when the debate is about the white working class. I don't like the term, Jeff, because I think the working class is all different colours and races. Yeah. I'm often accused, when I use the term traditional working class, I mean, it's, you know, it's a euphemism for white working class. Now, the interesting thing there, I think when people accuse me of that, they're actually betraying their own prejudice. Because if you're saying to me that, you know, the black worker who came over on the Windrush, for example, and worked on the London Underground transport system, or the Asian family who came over in the 50s and 60s and settled in a northern mill town, that they can't be considered part of the traditional working class in Britain because they're not white, then I think actually you probably need to look at yourself if you're making that sort of argument. So No, I don't think we should get too deep into to talk about the white working class. I don't think we need to wage a culture war on behalf of the white working class. The working class is all different colours, and you know, whether you're black or white, if you're suffering from low wages, substandard housing, all the pressures of society, then the left should be rallying to your cause and not seeking to divide you from each other. But can I just say that's different from the issue of free movement. The issue of free movement is not about colour as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's, you know, there's a legitimate argument to say, well, actually, free movement from the EU effectively gives 600 million white people the right to come here. But if you're an African or someone from the West Indies and want to come here, you have to jump through hoops. So you know, I think we should separate the issue of free movement from the issue of you know, the white working class and those sorts of debates.
Well, that, I mean, like, I get a lot. So whenever I talk about class on this podcast, people say, oh, you're banging on about class. You know, that old phrase, chip on your shoulder, which you've gone away from. While has now come back. But I do wonder if the Brexit sort of exposed that fault line, because it, like you say, it was an alliance, wasn't it? There was two groups of people that weren't that similar. This kind of deal was, you vote for us, we'll look after you when we get in power. But then there was that moment after Brexit where everything dropped, didn't it? Like, kind of the artifice, like, there were opinions shared about kind of leave voters and stuff, and that is that since then been a fault line, a chasm between two strands of Labour. Do you think that it's ever going to be possible to kind of like heal that wound?
I think it potentially is possible, but I mean, from Labour's point of view, there's an absolute mountain to climb, and it's still, you know, still only in the foothills at the moment. I mean, what it needs to do, first of all, it needs to radically change itself. I think the Labour Party, it needs to stop hating the working class. I don't sort of say that loosely. It needs to.
But do you think it's as strong as hate? Because people might take what's the evidence that they actually hate the working class?
Oh, there's contempt. I mean, you know, I've been active on the left for 26 years, and sometimes it's hidden, sometimes it slips out. But there's a sneering, you know, mockery sometimes of the working class, and a general kind of underlying contempt. Look at the Emily Thornberry thing with the white van and the flag in Rochester. Now he had a sort of, at the time she was a shadow cabinet minister who went to, you know, it was clearly, you know, a sort of working class estate in Rochester, and you know, the people living there with the white van outside and the St George's flag, and she clearly, you know, she's obviously middle class Islingtonian, and she clearly thought that this image was so noteworthy that it was worth tweeting, you know, in a kind of sneering way. And she, in many respects, and you know, you mentioned the Gordon Brown thing with Gillian Duffy, these kinds of things, occasionally the mask slips, and you see. And if people at the top are saying those sorts of things, you can imagine what some of the activists are saying. So there is, in my mind, no doubt a kind of underlying contempt towards what they see as reactionaries and bigots and social conservatives and people who believe in all that kind of patriotism and a sense of community and a sense of place. And they might have, you know, unfashionable opinions on things like law and order and immigration and national security. They believe in the nation state. And because of that, you know, people on the left who think they're imbued with the principles of the Enlightenment and they're inherently better people the whole time, you know, they're liberals and progressives, they just assume that they're better people, and these working class communities have to be dragged out of their ignorance. And that feeling has got more pronounced over the years. That sentiment now is much stronger than it ever was, in my view.
When you look going back in the 70s, how many Labour MPs came from sort of manual working class backgrounds to now? I think it's gone from something like 70% to something like 7%. I mean, it's just a ridiculous journey that they've gone on there. You look at where the Labour vote resides now. Again, huge amounts of it are ABC One adults who are in metropolitan city centres. So if anyone's listening, sort of thinking that we're just kind of like, you know, this is hyperbole, the metrics are there, and that's happened in a relatively short space of time, which I guess, you know, the one thing I wonder in a way is, you say that you're socially conservative. What is it about? What is Labour about you? Is it the economics? Because I wonder, have you ever flirted with, you know, the Tories, or certainly as they've moved a bit economically left, where are you at?
No, I've never flirted with the Tories. I don't think I ever would. I mean, I grew up in a Labour heartland. I was an activist in a trade union from when I got a Saturday job stacking the shelves in the local Asda when I was 16. You know, they didn't, the old saying, they didn't count the votes, the Labour votes in Barking and Dagenham, they weighed them. And I just, you know, my dad was a shop steward for, I mean, neither of my parents were particularly political, but they're both basically Labour. My dad was a shop steward for his works depot. My mum worked for the GMB union for several years as a secretary. So in that sense, it was a little bit tribal, and it still is. But I just genuinely believe that for all its faults at the moment, the Labour Party remains the vehicle and has historically always been the vehicle best placed to advance the interests of working class people. I think that, you know, in terms of the advances made by working class people over the years, whether it's, you know, a minimum wage, whether it's a national health service, a welfare state, whether it's, you know, council housing, decent housing, all of these things have largely been brought about by the Labour movement, by campaigns by the Labour movement. But in 2016, people voted for the first time because they thought they could change the system. They thought they could change society in a way that a general election, you know, their vote often doesn't particularly count. And when you had this huge exercise, 33.5 million people took part, and a majority said we want to leave the EU, and they did that. This is the ironic thing. Most people voted leave because they felt the political establishment over many years had stopped listening to them, and then that same political establishment set about proving those people right and tried to subvert the vote. And because Labour was such a big part of trying to overturn the vote, I think that had a significant, it wasn't by any stretch, it wasn't the only reason people fell out of
it. It was a lot. I mean, when I did that documentary and I was in places like Ashfield and in the East Midlands, it wasn't just that they changed from Labour, they hated Labour. Like it was much more than just like swing votes. I mean, you were outspoken on Brexit and you spoke at that rally in London, but there were consequences for you, weren't there, in terms of your union? Do you just explain what happened in and around that?
Yeah, I lost my job over it.
Your union sacked you for speaking at the pro-leave rally?
Well, to get it absolutely right, because there's going to be an employment tribunal, so it's important that I'm completely accurate about how it's reported. To get it absolutely right, they didn't sack me just for speaking at the rally. They sacked me. I mean, in my view, it was a pretext. You know, it was completely manipulated. But they sacked me technically for something that I said during the rally. So during the rally, I gave a speech for about 4 or 5 minutes. It's available on YouTube, so people can, you know, tell that I'm not lying here. Yeah. And during the speech, I made a specific statement where I, at this time, there were leaders of the Labour movement who were trying to subvert the Brexit result. This was in 2019. We still weren't out of the EU. The Theresa May government had got another extension. People were getting quite angry about it. And I said that the leaders of the Labour movement were in danger of making the movement irrelevant by being seen to take the side of the establishment over the people. Now, you can disagree with that. I felt that was a legitimate point to make in the speech.
Which has been proved right by in the fullness of time. Yeah.
Exactly. But my union leadership decided that simple statement amounted to an attack on the whole Fire Brigades union, my union. Even though the FBU wasn't even mentioned during the speech, I wasn't introduced as an FBU official. The speech took place in my own time on a Friday evening. And they used that as a pretext for elbowing me out. And, you know, that's the consequence of standing up for Brexit as part of the Labour movement.
Is that because are they particularly sort of progressive or woke? Because people wouldn't think a fire brigade union of all unions would behave in such a way.
You'd be surprised. I mean, we've got a leadership that I wouldn't necessarily call them woke particularly, but they kind of come, some of the senior officials come very much from a kind of Trotskyist tradition. So they've got pretty hardline politics, and they were kind of vehemently anti-Brexit, and I don't think they liked the fact that I was campaigning for the other side, even though we've had a rich tradition in the FBU and in the wider trade union movement of a diversity of opinion and being able to express your own view on things, especially if you're speaking in a personal capacity. On this occasion, they said, no, you ain't getting away with that. Bang, you're out of the door. So, you know, pretty unnecessary. And
how did that feel?
Well, I love the FBU. Even now, I think it's a fantastic union. It's done so many good things for firefighters over the years, in terms of improving their pay and conditions, improving the fire service, making people more safe through their campaigns and stuff. And I was an FBU rep for 20 years at different levels of the union. I worked my way up to the national executive of the union, and really enjoyed doing it. And I think I was okay at it. It wasn't pleasant. It was not a pleasant experience at all, and it was unnecessary. It was wrong. I think most people now see it was wrong, but that was the price I paid for criticising leaders of the Labour movement over their position on Brexit.
What do you think about, you know, Starmer at the moment?
Well, I've got a slightly nuanced opinion on him because, I mean, I have to say he wasn't my leader of choice. In fact, I didn't vote for any of the candidates because none of them.
But you didn't want Rebecca Long-Bailey to lead this?
I initially was very cynical about Starmer, quite pessimistic. I kind of thought, you know, he's your typical North London Liberal lawyer, very much a Blairite, I felt, privately. Not someone who at all understood, you know, Stoke-on-Trent or Wakefield or Grimsby and these sort of old Red Wall constituencies. And I thought, yeah, especially he was the architect of the second referendum policy as well. Let's not forget, which was absolutely disastrous.
The six mythical tests of Brexit.
all of this sort of stuff. And so I was cynical. But I have to say, I think he's done okay. I think he understands. I mean, I like the fact that he said about Brexit, look, for Christ's sake, let's just get it done. Let's mention it as little as possible. Let's just try and get it out of the way.
Do you understand why that's a hard pill for the Corbynistas to swallow? Because he was the architect. Suddenly the geezer gets in power. He's like, look, what's done is done.
Yeah, oh, bloody hell, sorry. That's
me. Brexit means Brexit. And I must admit, like, you know, I had a lot of beef with the Corbynistas, but when you look at, like, they did say for a long time, the Blairites, that if you had a Blairite-style leader in, they'd be 20 points ahead, and that, frankly, hasn't happened. You know, I mean, where were you on Corbyn? Were you...
I was not as critical as Corbyn as some people thought I should have been, actually. I think that on the economics, I think he did a lot of good. He took Labour in a direction of clear opposition to austerity, whereas I think previous leaders had been very wishy-washy about that. I think he was prepared economically to challenge vested interests in a way that previous leaders weren't prepared to do. And actually, despite what people think, some of that stuff is quite popular around the country. I mean, there's a big support out there for things like, you know, redistribution of wealth, for tackling regional inequalities, for tackling boardroom excesses, for a higher minimum wage and all of that sort of thing, much of which he articulated. Where I think he took the Labour Party further away from working class communities was on the cultural and social stuff. He did nothing to close that divide at all, which is why I say now the task for Labour is to marry that radical economic policy with the cultural politics of place and belonging. And as I say, I mean, I think Starmer has shown that he's understanding that. I mean, if you look at some of the messaging on Brexit, I think he's right. Let's just get it out of the way. It's done. Let's just try and not mention it and hope it moves off the radar as soon as possible. Let's start pressing the buttons that people in those Red Wall constituencies like to hear. Let's start talking about things like family and nation and community and work. If you look at his conference speech he gave a couple of months ago, and it was only a speech to camera, obviously, but his conference speech concentrated heavily on all of those themes. And I think I know for a fact that he's got some good people around him. His director of policy is a woman called Claire Ainslie, who's written some really good stuff around Brexit and the importance of family, stuff that other people on the left think is intrinsically right wing. So I think he's done a steady job. I've been quietly impressed with some of the stuff that he's been doing. And I say that as someone who was very cynical about his leadership.
What most people think.
You know, as we bring in here, and I know that a lot of people listening will already think that, is that, and I think this, if there was more people like you as a voice in Labour politics, you could win back people. Why are you not in the party? Why are you not an MP or a figure within the modern Labour Party?
I don't think the party would have me as an MP. I've got no real designs to be an MP, I've got to be honest, but I don't think the party would have someone like me as an MP. You would need to go to... You'd need to put yourself forward, throw your hat in the ring, and go before a constituency Labour Party and convince them that you're the right person to represent them. And the problem is, So many people, so many of the activists within CLPs just hate some of the stuff that I argue. And, you know, I think would run a mile from the idea of having someone like me as their member of parliament. Despite the fact that I think some of the arguments I articulate resonate far more with traditional Labour voters out there and working class voters than some of the arguments they articulate. So they kind of see things through the prism of ideology. The thing is that we're kind of a fringe tendency. We're almost like museum pieces in the party now, because the party has shifted so much and gone so much in favour of that cohort, that sort of middle-class, metropolitan, liberal activist. If you stand for the stuff that I stand for within the party, you don't get very far. It's certainly in terms of advancement, you don't get very far.
Well, I think it's a shame, you know, because I think the one thing that people saw, you know, with Andy Burnham speaking on the tier system, what a difference it makes when there's a bit of passion and sense of belonging. It's not Keir Starmer's fault that he's got that voice. You know, it's not a great voice, but communicate. No, I said to him, you know, it's not the best voice, and I'm sure that he has it in him.
Elections are won and lost on the gut issues. You know, people think when they go in the ballot box, people think, you know, how is this party going to run the economy? What's it going to do in terms of my, you know, financial well-being? How are they going to deal with issues that matter to me? You know, I've got a drug dealer at the corner of my street and they're dabbling in drugs, keeping us awake at night. What are the Labour Party or the Tories going to do about stuff like that? What are they going to do about immigration? How are they looking after us in terms of national security? You know, housing. My son can't get on the housing ladder because, you know, we're not building enough council houses. My mum can't get into hospital and have a hip operation because of the waiting list. Those are the issues. So for as long as Labour is talking about LGBT rights and migrant rights and gender fluidity and climate change and all of this stuff, which is important, and I don't dismiss it, it's got its place, of course. I mean, you'd be mad not to talk about climate change, for example. But the problem is these kind of middle class causes, as I've described them, front and centre of Labour activists' activity and their beliefs, but they're not doorstep issues. And the doorstep issues, you know, which people disregard as Tory issues, law and order, immigration, national security, those are the issues that cause Labour activists to stare at the ground and shuffle their feet in embarrassment. And until they understand that they've got to put those issues first and their own, you know, pursuits second, then they're never going to win back the hearts and minds of traditional working class voters.
I think that's a great place to leave it. But for balance, I have to echo what the Twitter reaction would be to that. Is, oh, yeah, again, Paul Embry pretending that gender fluidity isn't a priority in Sunderland. What does he know? That's all they talk about up there.
Of course. They're clamouring for it. I know they are.
Well, listen, mate, it's a great chat. Just talk about your book again. Where should people go to get it and order it? It's on sale now, unlike my book, which is on
Yeah, it's on sale. It's available from all good booksellers. It's available, you know, in bookshops and online. It's called Despised: Why the Modern Left Loathe the Working Class. It's available paperback and Kindle and hardback and in all different sorts of versions.
Brilliant. Paul, thank you so much for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, so that is the end of the chat with Paul Embry there. Do check out his book, Despised. You know, I think that obviously there'll be ideas there that you'll want to pick up on and talk about. If you want to pick up on anything Paul said or anything that I've said in the podcast, it is whatmostpeopleThinkUK@gmail.com or any letters. Do you want to discuss anything? Any old bollocks? And speaking of which, let's answer a couple of letters now. Okay, the first letter is from... Who's it from? This is from Dave B. He says, I haven't heard a virtual political fight on your podcast for a while. I think a lot of the interesting bouts got done. I mean, by all means, if you want to email one in, you want me for consideration, then do it. But he says, however, given the levels of animosity in the world at the moment, and with it being Christmas and all, perhaps we should try to spread love, not war. I'm totally on board with this, Dave. So I will ask instead, not who is the hardest politician, but who is the hottest. This thought process, this is the way we should be talking about politics, to be honest. This thought process started because one of my left-leaning mates recently confessed to our group that his guilty pleasure is a penchant for a certain Priti Patel. Well, whose isn't, for God's sake? I'd like to check out her hostile environment. That's not okay, is it? That's not okay. So he says, in the interest of being totally PC, I'd like an answer for both hottest female and male.
And he says, we all know you have something of a man crush on Dishy Rishi, but is there anyone else you dream of at night? Well, look, you know, Rishi, so I did a bit of research on this, Dave, and the Daily Mail ran something about this a month ago, and I would put Dishy Rishi at the top. He's a bit on the short side, but actually, surprisingly, a lot of them are. Boris Johnson, Dishy, and Keir Starmer, all quite short blokes at the moment. But Keir Starmer came second. So not only is Rishi more popular, Rishi's better looking. Rishi's more bangable, yeah? Rishi life hack, I call him. He's just winning at life. Whereas Keir, you know, look, I would imagine as a woman, you'd look at Keir and go, yeah, like if I'd had a really tumultuous relationship and I just needed a solid guy who maybe didn't deliver in the bedroom, but was certainly dependable, then that's Keir Starmer. And a lot of women seem to like Tobias Elwood as well, this Tory MP. I had a look at him. He's another one of those ones that's a bit past me. I don't think he's all that. But I think women sense his breeding. They're just smelling that money coming off him. Speaking of the women, I think the Tories punch above their weight here. I mean, just check them out. There's a lot. There was Heidi Allen before she became Change UK and then just changed into not being a politician. She was an attractive woman, you know. Esther McVeigh, you know, a lot of people into Esther the Hair McVeigh. There's a lot of younger, this is where it starts to go wrong, doesn't it? Just perving out. I'm not saying Labour have got some contenders there. Rosina Allen Khan, attractive woman. It's a very pretty name, Rosina. But interestingly, Nicola Sturgeon came six. I'm not saying anything. I didn't say it. She came six with 4% of the vote. And 4% of the vote is roughly the share of the electorate that lives in Scotland. So I'm not saying that those two things are connected. I'm not doubting that Nicola Sturgeon is within her own right sexy as fuck. One more letter we're doing here. This is picking up on the long-running theme of the woman who started farting around her husband after several years of marriage. And we've had quite a lot of correspondence on this. This is coming from Danny, this one. He says, I'm working back through back issues and have to belatedly reply to the bloke who's upset about his wife farting in his presence. If your relationship hasn't reached the point where you can fart around each other, it's too early for marriage. That's a massive shout, Danny. Massive shout. My wife and I have been together for 22 years and have farted around each other since very early on. Although naturally I started it, well, I didn't doubt that for a second, Danny, and I've always farted a lot more than she has. Said with some pride, Danny, I quite like that. I'm still a man. Do you know what I mean? It's never bothered me. Recently, she started farting a bit more often. Frankly, it makes a nice change from the belching. Well, look, Danny, whatever works for you, works for you. It's sexist of me. And I'm not, but that's the thing, is like, I don't fart like loads around my wife. I might let the odd one go. If I think it's got comic value, I mean, particularly one when you're on the move. I mean, that is, especially outside, the jeopardy's low. She's not really going to smell it. You know, I try to be a gentleman in that respect. And I just want to nurture. I'm sorry if it's old-fashioned. The idea that women generally smell a bit nicer than men. I think actually they do smell a bit nicer. I mean, when you have a... Have you ever had like one of your mates stay over for two nights in the spare room? And you just go, oh, shit, like... That's his musk right there. We've got his musk. You don't really get that with women. I don't know if that's because women pull some shit where they're fucking like getting out little Febreze that they use, some woman Febreze that we don't know about that they carry around with them. But I respect that you have that in your marriage, Danny. And may the farts keep. I mean, it'd be weird if she stopped farting and that made you think something was wrong. Do you know what I mean? I think she's farting for another man. Okay, that is the end of this week's podcast. As ever, if you leave me a 5-star review, or why am I speaking so slow? That is the end of this week's podcast. If you leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, I will read it out. I think we've got a couple this week. Let's have a look. This is from, Blondie. Okay, you said Blondie, so I have to do it in a sexist Blondie voice. I don't usually like it when Jeff has guests and sometimes don't listen to the whole episode, but really enjoyed Leo because he was so funny. Also enjoyed there being no cuss count because I find it really boring and pointless. Well, I'm sorry, Blondie. I think that the majority do enjoy it, but again, what most people think, uk@gmail.com. Maybe I'll do a poll on the Patreon page, you know, a bit of market research. This is from Dee Dee Girl. Jeff makes me feel... There's hope that humour is still alive and kicking. He's clever, funny and sharp-witted. Saw him in Stourport last year. Bought tickets for my brother, bought tickets for my brother to go and see him in Reading in 2021. Go and see his show, he's awesome. Yeah, she's right, go and see my show, I am fucking awesome, thank you. This is a good one to finish with. This is from a Dutch person. He says, I'm Dutch, do your worst. Okay, I'm going to read this Dutch guy. This is my favorite podcast. I actually make time to listen to it. This is obviously a Dutch guy that's had a stroke now. It's a perfect mix of solo episodes and guest episodes. Jeff is not afraid to invite guests that are smarter than him. Oh, there it is. The classic Dutch guy slam. Yeah, this is why you guys never do well at World Cups, because you're always so it always has to be a falling out, doesn't there, with the Dutch lads? If you don't care for politics, this podcast taught me everything I know about cricket. Well, listen, man, that is a real buzz to find out that someone is listening in Holland. And we still love you. We love Europe. What is not to like about Holland? I mean, fuck me. Seriously, it's just the EU. We're going our separate ways. And, you know, I hope we have a deal. But if not, please let us still smoke weed in Amsterdam. That's where this was all going, basically. Please do not exclude us from one of the greatest cities on God's earth.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.